1978 or 9 or so, there was this exotic quantum object, the hole, that was discovered, which came from the Pauli principle and the idea of having filled bands, and a small number of particles missing from a filled band in a material could act like a positive charge carrier. It explained at a stroke why aluminum has a positive Hall coefficient instead of a negative one, which was a great mystery to the classical physicists. And there's a quantum mechanical energy scale of the energy gap, which is 15,000 Kelvin, and it's very important for the operation of your computer that you be deep in the quantum limit around 300 Kelvin. Also point out that if you have a 1,000, I guess they're called 1,000 megahertz Pentiums in the advertisements, but a 1 gigahertz Pentium, H bar times the clock frequency is 50 millikelvin. So we're getting up there. Pretty soon they're going to be radiation hazards. Okay, so a quantum bit is just a two-level system that can be in the a one or a zero state, like a classical bit, and I'm going to use a pseudo-spin language, up and down, to represent those two cases. And the thing that's new with quantum mechanics is you can have some amplitude to be both at the same time, linear superposition. If you have n such bits, then the basis vectors are just can be the set of n bit numbers. And you need an amplitude in front of each one of those basis vectors to specify the state. So there's a lot of things that are determined, 2 to the n things that are determined when you specify the state. Entanglement turns out to be an important thing in quantum information theory. You can make states in which you're uncertain whether these spins are up or down. All you know is that if one is up, the other one's up. If one's down, the other one's down, but you don't know which is which. So a computation consists of, it's just a quantum mechanical experiment. Like all quantum experiments, you prepare a state, you evolve the state under some Hamiltonian or unitary time evolution operator, and then you make a measurement. And reason that the quantum computer can be very fast, actually many people it's very popular in the field to think of the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, and I discovered this. I mean, Matthew Fisher made an interesting remark about this, and I discovered actually this is a common viewpoint in this field. The reason they're so fast is that they carry out the calculation in all these different universes at the same time. The reason that developing algorithms is hard is you have to find an algorithm that gives the same answer in every universe. And that's quite a precise statement of why it's hard. You need to, you cannot measure all those 2 to the n amplitudes in one shot, right? Because you can't measure non-commuting observables, for example, at the same time. So you need to find an algorithm that puts all the signal in one place, and you can unambiguously find out what the answer is without quantum fluctuations in the answer, if you will. And there's very few algorithms that have been developed that can do that, although, of course, some of them are pretty important. Yeah. Pardon? The program is in the, it's in both, but I mean the program is in the unitary evolution. And the hard part is then to find, the information is in there, but it has to be encoded in such a way that you can get it out. And if you had to do the calculation over and over again to get some ensemble average to get build up statistics because there were quantum fluctuations, then there's a problem. Okay, so I'm actually not that much about the quantum information end of things, and I'm more interested in the physics of why this will be difficult to do. What you need to be able to do are one-bit operations, such as some unitary operation like this rotation in spin space, where these are the Pauli, 2x2 Pauli spin matrices. And for instance, you can use those to make a NOT gate that takes an up to a down or a down to an up. And you also need to be able to do two-bit gate operations. For example, one that people talk about a lot is the controlled NOT operation. You want to perform a NOT on the second bit. You want to invert the second bit if and only if the first bit is up. So this operator here will do that job for you. And if you have the right set of operations like that, you can produce universal computation. So for instance, just to show you how you can use those two operations to produce an entangled state, suppose I start with two bits that are down, I rotate the first one about the y-axis by pi over 2 pulse in NMR language, so that I have it's pointing now in the x direction, which is a linear combination of up plus down, okay? And then I apply a controlled knot to flip the second guy if the first guy is up. And it acts on all of the different amplitudes at the same time, right? You don't have to do these one at a time. Quantum mechanics is linear and acts on all the pieces of the linear superposition at the same time. And so this guy is not flipped, and that guy is flipped, and that's an entangled state. If you have lots and lots of these, you can make things which are these so-called Schrodinger cat states, where they're two very, very sort of extremely different configurations, and you have some coherent amplitude to be in both. And if you're an atomic clock person, and if you can figure out a way to do this, and people are thinking about doing this, your precision of frequency measurement scales with n rather than root n if you have access to such states and if there are no dephasing effects. All right, so how do we make a one-bit gate? If we have a two-level system with a energy splitting h bar omega between them, then Hamiltonian would just be h bar omega over 2 times sigma z. And then I can apply a classical, and this is a little bit tricky, what do you mean by a classical field, but a classical oscillating perturbation, oscillating at exactly the resonant frequency, omega, and having an operator, say, sigma x, which is able to cause transitions between the two sigma z states. Then, within a certain approximation, I can rewrite this in what's called the rotating wave approximation, throwing away a certain piece of it. If I calculate the unitary time evolution operator, it's just rotations about the x-axis. Okay? So, roughly speaking, I'm driving the system from here to here, and once it's up there, stimulated emission is I'm driving it back down. So it's oscillating back and forth. In practice, it's actually rotating about the x-axis. And the probability, if you stop after time t and measure the probability that the spin was up, it will oscillate in time at a rate called the Rabi flopping rate, which is proportional to the amplitude, not the intensity, of the applied perturbation. The stronger the amplitude, the faster it cycles back and forth. Okay? So if I wait the correct length of time, I can rotate the system by pi over 2 or pi or whatever angle I want. And people in NMR do that all the time. I'm really not sure how I'm going to do on time here, but I'll try this. There's a quantum version of this. I said you apply a classical field just oscillating cosine omega t. Well, if you recognize that the classical field, say, it's photons and they're really quantized, the story's a little bit different. You have, that's supposed to be a sigma z. If you have photons whose energy is exactly the energy needed to make a transition from one level to the other, and you again make this same rotating wave approximation, we can classify the states in the following way. There's a spin-down state, and then a tower of states corresponding to an integer number of photons in the cavity with the spin. And there's an up state and another tower of states corresponding to the number of photons. And because the energy difference for the spin is exactly equal to the energy of the photon, this state and that state are exactly degenerate. This state and that state are exactly degenerate. Because I've tuned the photon energy to equal the spin splitting. Again, that's supposed to be a sigma z there. So if I throw away the pieces of this interaction, which mix me across here, and just keep these, that's this rotating wave approximation, then this coupling, say the dipole matrix element between the photon and the two levels in the atom, lifts this degeneracy, gives a small splitting, which is this Rabi splitting. And if you start out in this state, you'll go over there and back and forth, under the influence of that small splitting. So what that does is not give you a linear superposition of up and down, a coherent spin pointing in the x direction. Instead, it entangles the spin with the photon field, which is a very different thing from having a classical perturbation that just rotates the spin over. So if you have Fox states for the photon field, then you're going to have entanglement between the spins and the photons. If you can use a coherent state for the photon field, which is what a laser does and which is in some sense what a classical the most classical perturbation you can make, then because you're uncertain how many bosons are in there, because it's an eigenstate of the field destruction operator, then you can actually get a coherently rotated state, and you're not entangled with the boson field, because you weren't certain how many bosons there were in the field in the first place. Okay, does that make sense? So that's actually now. Then you can get into questions which I don't understand, which is, can you make a coherent state without having that entangled with whatever it was that made it? And then you get into philosophical questions about what this is all about, which I'm going to ignore. Okay, so if you have a two-level system and some kind of matrix element between them with a perturbation that you can control, you can make one-bit gates. You can make arbitrary rotations of that state. Two-bit gates are where the engineering gets harder. You have to have these guys isolated from the environment, and you have to turn on some kind of interaction between the two physical things that are representing the bits. Okay. So suppose I have two-level systems, and with this Hamiltonian, which it's not the most generic general Hamiltonian, but I can make some unitary transformation to always put it in this form, and complicate some other part of the problem. So let's say, again, using this pseudo-spin language, here's the ground state, both spins down. Here's how much it costs in energy to flip one spin, or I could have flipped the other spin, which costs energy E2, or I could flip them both up. Okay? And I'm going to rig things up so that all four of these transition energies are different. And in particular, I want to have a finite energy shift if both spins are up. That's the interaction strength, lambda. Okay? And then if E1 and E2 are different and lambda is not zero, I can rig it up so that all four of those frequency shifts are different. And now I can do a controlled knot. Okay? So suppose it happens that I don't have the ability to separately excite this one and this one, that my perturbation, my laser, or whatever is under my control, actually couples symmetrically to both at the same time. That sounds bad. How am I going to flip one and not the other? How am I going to flip one only if and only if the first one is up, say. Well, it turns out to be relatively easy. If all of these energies are different, then I can do a controlled knot in the following way. So suppose that the I'm in this state. So the first spin is up, the second one is down, and I want to flip this one. The controlled knot will flip this one, whereas if I have some amplitude to be in this state, it will not flip that one. So all I have to do is supply a laser with this energy, E2 plus lambda, which is not resonant with the other things, and therefore will hardly cause any other transitions, but will resonantly, if I wait long enough, even if it's weak, it will eventually cause a rotation. So I do a pi pulse at this frequency, and I get the controlled knot operation. Okay. If E1 and E2 had been equal, or lambda had been zero, there's some operations that you cannot do. Yeah.
Is there a way of beforehand setting?
So suppose I'm here and I. Yeah, so if I'm, let's say I wait a long time and the system settles in the ground state, I'm here, then I can excite it with a field, a perturbation at energy E1, and do a pi pulse which will rotate the first spin and will have no effect on this one, or almost no effect because it's far off resonance. Okay? You might ask, is there some way to get myself into some more complicated linear combination of different states, and there are, using more complicated perturbations on the system. Does that make sense? So for instance, I'm not going to talk about the excitons in quantum dots, but there are these circumstances in a condensed matter system where you can confine in a small region two particle hole excitations, a singlet and a triplet, and they have some interaction with each other. And it's described by exactly this little circumstance, although the interaction Hamiltonian and the perturbation may be slightly more complicated than that. The rate at which you can get these things to go is depending on exactly what operation you're talking about, depends on how strong this interaction is between the two bits. You've got to do something to one subject to that guy finding out what the state of the other one is, like in a controlled knot. And the fastest you can do that is h bar over the interaction energy. Okay. So what can go wrong? Well, there's always noise, vacuum fluctuations, 1 over F noise, all kinds of grubby details. The coupling of the environment to this system. So you could have your two-level system, and you could have, so you could imagine some fluctuating perturbation which couples to sigma z or to sigma x and sigma y. And they do different things, and if you're familiar with NMR language, this is sort of old hat, but I'll just remind you. If you have this term, well, this commutes with the original Hamiltonian. It just takes the two levels and modulates their energy spread. If you had a harmonic oscillator, it would be just like periodically or gently changing the spring constant or the mass. And what that does is cause, if you're in a linear combination of these two states, so the spin is in the xy plane, it processes faster and slower as the level splitting goes up and down. And it gets out of phase. It loses the phase, diffuses. That's a standard model for what happens in lasers. The phase of the frequency is determined by some atomic transition, but the phase is not fixed and diffuses around according to noise. And so the transverse correlation function will decay either exponentially or as a Gaussian with some characteristic time that's called T2. If you have this kind of perturbation, that which is sigma x and sigma y, that causes transition. So if you start up here in a high energy state, it will relax down there. And that rate is called T1. So the this rate, 1 over T1, is the spectral density of the noise at the frequency that you need to cause the transition. The phase correlation time is the spectral density of this noise at low frequencies. So the key thing to understand about this, if you haven't seen it before, it's probably, takes a while to get used to, but the key thing to understand is that the phase can relax even if the energy isn't relaxing. Energy decay rates and phase decay rates can be completely separate, okay? So you don't need a transition from here to here, a loss of energy, to screw up the phase. You just have to gently modulate the two levels like that, and the computer fails, okay? That's bad. So phase is very delicate and hard to control. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you about the ion trap quantum computing hardware, which currently exists, basically because it's absolutely amazing what the atomic people can do these days, and it's kind of fun to see what they're up to. So they use an RF trap, a Paul trap, which is sort of a quantum mechanical quadrupole mass spectrometer in some sense. There's four metal rods here. There's some static potentials out here, which trap some beryllium ions in here. There's a very high frequency, high voltage RF signal that's put on two of these guys. And the ions undergo some funny orbits in the presence of that high frequency signal. And it effectively produces, at low frequencies, a harmonic potential that traps the ions in here. Okay. So for my purposes, I'm going to think of this as a bunch of particles repelling each other because of their charge. These are beryllium plus. They're about 10 microns apart. Here's a little fluorescence image of those guys inside there. And they can't move this way and this way, and they oscillate harmonically this way. That turns out to be a pretty good approximation. Okay. So one nice thing is that on the average, they're not accelerating anywhere, so the time average of the electric field, which is a perturbation on the atoms, is zero, which is going to help the stability. So, remind you that beryllium plus has one s electron out here. L equals zero, spin 1/2, J is 1/2, and the nucleus has spin 3/2 for beryllium 9, and there are two states, F equals 2 and F equals 1, of the grand total angular momentum. And those states are split apart in a weak magnetic field in a scheme like this, not to scale, and this splitting, this hyperfine splitting in zero field is 1.25 gigahertz. And we're going to take two of these states, and those are going to be our bits, our bit, okay? This will be what I'll call spin down, that'll be spin up. And I'm going to use the word spin, but I really mean hyperfine states. And these states differ in the physical orientation of the nuclear and electronic spins, okay? But when I say spin, I'll mostly mean this up and down, okay? So it's a clock, it's a computer that can run fairly fast because that's a pretty high energy scale, although the Pentiums are catching up. What's really nice about this system is it's extremely isolated from the environment. The average electric field is zero because it's not, the particles aren't accelerating anywhere. The spontaneous decay, the T1, due to emitting photons, it's only magnetic dipole, it's not electric dipole allowed, so the T1 is bigger than 10 to the fifth years. So that's not a problem, as far as we know. And the particular transition I'm going to tell you about does not satisfy this condition, but there are others that they could use which have a splitting delta that depends on the magnetic field, and there's some level repulsion like this, and there's an extremum in the splitting, a minimum with respect to B, and if you sit at that B field, the measured T2 is bigger than 10 minutes, okay? So here's an example of a low frequency transition. It's only 303,016,377.265 hertz. And they put in a pi over 2 pulse, start the atoms processing around, they go out for coffee, they have a, you know, look out the window in Boulder at the mountains, they come back, and they send in one more pi over 2 pulse 10 minutes later, assuming that their oscillator is still in phase with the atom, and tilt them back up. And at the predicted moment, or down in this case, it works. If they use a slightly different frequency oscillator, it gets out of phase with the atoms. If they differ by 1 millihertz, after 10 minutes, they get out of phase. And they apologize here for the slight noise in the data. It's due to their cheap reference oscillator, which wasn't quite as accurate as the atoms. Now, this is the amazing part. Despite this incredible isolation from the environment, they can do a readout which is 100% efficient. And this is a problem in any other realization of this system, of the quantum computing system. So the way they do the readout is they have something called a cycling transition. There's a 2p state up here, which is dipole allowed, okay? But there's a forest of these states up here, and in particular, the F equals 3, MF equals 3 state, you can tune a laser to, and if you have an extremely good circular polarizer, then the only place you can go from here is here, and the only place you can spontaneously decay from there is back here. And you can do that 100 million times a second, so if you shine a laser on here in resonance, you can see with your eyeball that the thing lights up, and you are definitely in this hyperfine state, and definitely not in that hyperfine state because it's dark. You can just see it with your eye. So, okay, they're not using their eye, they're using some little photomultiplier detector, and I didn't get the exact numbers, but assuming that the lifetime of the state's about 10 nanoseconds, then in 1 millisecond, if you pump hard, you can get 10 to the fifth fluorescence photons. If you detect 10 to the minus 3 of those, or 100 on average, then the probability that you won't see any is e to the minus 100, and that's good enough for, there are other weaker links in the operation. Now, this ignores lots of little details, dark current and dead times and stuff, but that's more or less the right answer. Now, you have to have very good circular polarization here, and somehow they're able to make it good enough that they can run this cycle about 1 million times before you accidentally get a transition to some other state due to imperfect polarization. And we only need to run it 10 times less than that to be assured, or even 100 times less than that, to be assured of finding out with almost certain exactness that you're in this state. Okay? Questions about that? One. Yeah. So one atom, if it has a lifetime, a radiative decay, spontaneous decay lifetime of 10 nanoseconds, you can get it to radiate very often. So you've got these atoms lined up in the trap. They're 10 microns apart. And you shine the laser through a lens, and you focus it on just one of the atoms. Right. Well, this is a cycling transition. The quantum numbers are such that if you use circularly polarized light, once you go up there, the only place you can fall down to is the same state. So it just goes back and forth, back and forth. That's right. It's not coherent. But that doesn't matter. We're just trying to see if there's any fluorescence. If I can get one fluorescence photon out, I know which state it's in because the other one never produces any. Everything's over. I'm just trying to find out what state it's in. Yeah, I didn't make that clear. So this is incoherent. This is the measurement process where all those photons scattering out in different directions you know, collapse the wave function, or however you want to think about it, but you find out you're in that state. Sorry, I didn't make that clear. Okay, so now we've got the readout, we've got these spins coherently processing, but now I need to do individual rotations on them. I need to do NMR at 1.25 gigahertz on little things one at a time that are only 10 microns apart. And the wavelength, if I put a magnet, a coil up there or something like with microwaves, or use microwaves, the wavelength is way too big to individually address these things. So what they do is they use stimulated Raman. They take two lasers, shine them through lenses, and they make the frequency difference between the two lasers 1.25 gigahertz, and they use some nonlinear interaction between them to get a beat frequency of 1.25 gigahertz, and they do NMR with that. So it's a little, it's interesting to think about how it actually works. So let me try to explain that. So these are 10 microns apart. You can focus these beams down to a couple of microns. And here's what happens. So let's say you're in this state, and you use a laser light which is almost energetic enough to bring you up to this forest of 2P states that you're, that I use in the readout there. And so you go up here, and you're there for, it's a virtual transition, you're there for a length of time h bar over this delta r. While you're up there, the electron now realizes that it has finite angular momentum around the nucleus, and the spin orbit coupling starts precessing the electron. So let's say the field, magnetic field was up, some electron was pointing this way. The photons, this is low energy physics, there's no P mu, gamma mu, thanks, Tony. So the photons don't flip any electron spins, okay? But spin orbit coupling can flip the electron spin. So there's a little magnetic field, the electron's this way, and you send in circularly polarized light that gives angular momentum at some angle to the field. And now the electron, the rest frame of the electron, it sees the nucleus whirling around it, which changes the direction of the magnetic field suddenly. So the spin begins to precess. And during that short length of time, h bar over delta r, you start precessing at some rate like that. So you get some finite amplitude to flip the spin. Then, in order to make sure that you end up back here, you have a second laser beam going, which stimulates the emission of photons from there and controls their energy because you've chosen the frequency of this beam. So the probability for emitting a photon from here is much larger if it has the same frequency and direction as these guys. So you can stimulate the system. This is Raman scattering with a spin flip, but it's stimulated because you don't have spontaneous decay from there. Okay? So this system has huge advantages because you actually only need one laser. And you can put in something and chop the beam at 1.25 gigahertz with an acousto-optic modulator. And that means that if there's a frequency drift in the laser, this frequency goes up a little bit. It doesn't matter because this one goes up and compensates. It's only the difference. And provided that the frequency fluctuations are small compared to the size of the energy denominator here, it's not going to have a big effect. And this microwave source is as accurate as you want. So you only need moderately stable lasers, which is good. So the net effect of all this fancy stuff, I'm now going to integrate out the high energy parts of the physics and just give you the low energy effect of Hamiltonian, is you have a sigma x, something that takes you from the down bit to the up bit state. It oscillates with frequency cosine omega, which is at your disposal. And you can make it match or not match this particular transition energy as you wish. And the Rabi flopping rate is proportional to its second order in the laser amplitude, so the laser power, and then something to do with the detuning and the strength of the spin orbit coupling. So you can't make it go too fast because it takes a while to process the spin over. Okay, so that works. That's been demonstrated. Now we come to a real problem, which is that these ions, okay, we can address them individually by moving the lenses and making the laser land on them one at a time, but how do we make a two-bit gate? Because they're not interacting with each other. And the example I showed you before, I said you have to have some interaction. So what they do instead is they use one more quantum mechanical degree of freedom, namely the center of mass motion of this set of ions in the trap. And the typical parameter is that this oscillation mode has a frequency of about 10 megahertz, 500 microkelvin. Okay, so what happens is the following: you have the two laser beams coming in, and you have your effective Hamiltonian. Before was just sigma x times cosine omega t, but now the phase of the laser beams varies with the oscillation of the center of mass. Okay, and the zero point where is it? The zero point, there it is. The zero point motion is about 50 angstroms. So it's a lot smaller than the wavelength of the laser, but it's not zero, and that's enough. Okay. So when you look at this Hamiltonian, you can see that there are terms which flip the pseudos, the bit, and also create or destroy center of mass phonon quanta. So you can now entangle, this is just like the thing I showed you before with the quantized field. You can entangle the spin flips with the quanta of the center of mass motion. And then you can move the lasers over here to this guy and entangle it with the center of mass bosons, and in the process eat up all those phonons and be left in the emotional ground state with some entangled pair of spins.
So this is a finite number, so there's a gap to the next quantum.
Yeah, so there are typically, they don't like, you know, if you get above about 7 ions, the internal phonon states start getting pretty thick. And it gets difficult. So they have some schemes for, which I used to think were completely crazy, but they're now starting to build gadgets so that they can take some of these and move them over here and store them, have a little racetrack, bring in some other ions. So they just work with 7 at a time and store the others over in some place for a while, and they actually have demonstrated parts of the technology needed to do that. So obviously, as the zero point, the scale of zero point motion goes down, this Lamb-Dickey parameter, which is just that dimensionless number, goes down, and the coupling to the phonons is weaker, and the gate speed goes down. It goes linearly in eta, but if this product, but if it, that gets too large, there's sort of a Debye-Waller factor that cuts it off. So this slows down the gate, but it still works.
But in the 10-minute time scale, the probability for basically tunneling, changing two particles is small.
Physically, yeah. No, that's, yeah. These are heavy. Right. Okay, so they're all moving together like this, and then there are other modes, and there are actually, events where two of them trade places. These experiments are being done in their millisecond timescales, not yet 10-minute timescales, because the atoms are coherent for 10 minutes, but I'm going to show you that this oscillator is not, and that's a problem. Okay, so you can make, what you need to do this is motion-controlled gate. So you need to be able to, say, flip a spin if and only if the oscillator is in the n equals 1 state instead of the ground state. So you can do that by lowering the frequency of the second laser beam by one quantum of oscillation. So the only way this transition can go is if you started in the n equals 1 state. If you start in the n equals 0, you end up with not enough energy to have made the transition. And with tricks like that, you can make gates which will entangle, will do anything that you need. Will entangle the spins with the center of mass phonons. So they have demonstrated what's called entanglement on demand. You tell them what state you want, they can make it. And so suppose we want to entangle the first beryllium ion with the third beryllium ion. So what you do is you entangle the first bit with you start out in the ground state, and they can cool the system down so it's in this ground state, even though it's 500 microkelvin, so it's easy. They entangle this flip. They either flip the spin or make a phonon excitation. Then there's another trick, which I won't explain, where they make a motion-dependent phase shift using some other hyperfine state as an auxiliary state. They change the sign if and only if n is 1. Then there's a motion-controlled knot. On the third spin, they move the lasers over, shine it on here, and they flip this spin if and only if n is 1. So in this part of the wave function, it flips, and that part it doesn't. And then you have a singlet between spins 1 and 3. And the current state of the art is they can do this for 4 spins. But it gets harder and harder as n goes up. Okay, so the big problem, right, or a problem, it's actually been solved, but it's some interesting physics, which is not particularly understood, is that the atoms are coherent, but this little 10 megahertz oscillator, it's charged, right? So it couples to electric fields, and it dephases and decoheres within a millisecond. That's a long time for these experiments, but still, it's short. So you think, you got this trap, you got two pieces of metal here, nice metals like molybdenum or gold or something that don't have these patch fields, everything should be fine. A piece of metal is an isopotential, right? We teach that. Well, there's some little electric fields in there that are out at, and there's some spectral density at 10 megahertz, and they heat up the oscillator. So they have a way, using optical tricks similar to what I've talked about, to map the quantum state of the oscillator onto the spin state of the ions, and then read it out with their lasers, okay? And they can measure the expectation value of n in the oscillator. And as a function of time, it goes up like so. Or they can measure, this is not the dephasing. This is the heating. This is not exactly dephasing. This is the fidelity of Rabi flopping. This is not the 10 megahertz oscillation of the coordinate. This is some Rabi flopping. But you can see it going down, and again, a tenth of a millisecond to a millisecond, depending on the acid wash that they use on this surface. And there's some stuff diffusing around, changing the work function or something. Nobody knows exactly. And it's happening at 10 megahertz, which seems kind of fast, but there it is.
Steve,
yeah?
At some point, don't you have to worry about we have this bus of ions moving around?
Yeah.
Because some of the ions, the ones in the middle and the ones at the end, is maybe slightly different environment.
Well, yeah, if there's a magnetic field gradient and you're not operating on a clock transition which has an extremum with respect to B, it's a problem. They both see at time average electric field zero, so.
The interactions between the ions are very weak, because of the separation.
Well, there's not much magnetic, it's magnetic dipole interactions, and they're 10 microns apart, so. And it goes down with the, so they have electric repulsion, but it, yeah, the hyperfine states are S, the electrons in an S state, there's a big excitation gap, so small electric fields don't do much. There's some small Stark shifts, but they're not, the time average is not a problem. So you can turn this around, actually, and use this to study electric fields and glassy fluctuations in glassy two-level systems and things. You can easily see a spectral density of noise of 1 nanovolt per meter per root hertz using the sensitivity of the quantum system to that. So you know, if it turns out to be such a problem that you can't make a computer, you can turn it around and use it to make it a feature, not a bug. But actually, this problem has been solved. What they do is they instead of using this mode, they use a laser to pin down and cool the central atom, and they use this mode, which is only couples to field gradients and is 6 orders of magnitude or 8 orders of magnitude something down, and it's not a problem. Okay, so in the remaining few minutes, I'll switch gears and talk about Cooper pair boxes. So superconductors have important physics controlled by pairs of electrons in time-reversed states. That's everything you need to know about superconductivity. So the idea is you have a superconductor, and then you have a little tiny mesoscopic chunk of superconductor with a tunnel junction connecting them. And that little chunk might contain 10 to the 8th pairs or something, but you can tell the difference between 10 to the 8th and 10 to the 8th plus 1. So those are going to be our two states for the qubit. And because there's an excitation gap in the superconductor, there's a whole bunch of single particle levels, and their spacing is too small to, that's much smaller than even the cold temperature that we have. But this gap can be much larger than the temperature. And you can get coherent tunneling. Even though electrons tunnel one at a time, not in pairs, you can get coherent tunneling of pairs because when the first guy tunnels, it leaves an odd number of electrons in each side. So there's two unpaired electrons that cost this energy 2 delta. That's a virtual state. And then it either tunnels back or its partner follows. And by integrating out this high energy virtual state, you can get an effective Josephson coupling that tunnels pairs coherently back and forth between the state n and n plus 1. So again, the effective low energy Hamiltonian for the tunneling is the Josephson energy over 2 times this sigma x.
What holds this small box in place? Is it that's
important? It's evaporated onto some solid substrate, and there's some little insulator between them. It's not, it's shown floating in space, but actually it isn't. Tony likes these technical experimental details, I know. So that's one energy, which is the energy to coherently tunnel back and forth, the bonding, anti-bonding energy, if you will, for the pairs. And there's also a Coulomb charging energy. This thing has such a small capacitance, one femtofarad, that a single electron on there, or a single pair, costs you a big energy. In fact, you don't want to put one more pair on there unless you have a sufficiently negative voltage on this gate to make it favorable. So you can actually tune this gate voltage so that the state with n and n plus 1 pairs is degenerate or not degenerate. That's under your control, okay? So that's going to be the control, unlike having, you know, laser fields and things. This is going to be the control. So there's a little spin Hamiltonian where you have something controlled by the gate and the tunneling, which is fixed, okay? So it's like a spin in a magnetic field, and you get to control the z component of the magnetic field, and you can change it quickly or slowly. So just to give you some numbers, Tony, they're a 10th micron box, temperature's 2 microvolts, the BCS gap, superconducting gap, is 200 microvolts, the charging energy is 120 microvolts, Josephson energy is 40 microvolts, the Rabi flopping rate, the rate at which you can coherently go back and forth, H over EJ, is about 100 picoseconds. So we're going to make motions of this control voltage, which are either fast or slow compared to this scale. And to make them fast compared to that scale, you have to be at NEC in Japan and have able to purchase a $500,000 pulse generator, which nobody in this country can do, at least from the NSF. So here's the experiment. You start over here with zero gate voltage, and you suddenly turn on a gate voltage which is favorable and makes the energy levels degenerate in charging energy, although they're split apart by the tunneling energy. And you do it quickly. So basically, you've suddenly moved from here to here. But remember, in the sudden approximation, the Hamiltonian changes, but the state doesn't change. So the spin is still pointing down. You're really here, which is a linear combination of the two eigenfunctions. So you begin to precess. You had a very large component of the fake magnetic field pointing the spin down, and you suddenly shut that off, and the spin, which was down, now begins to precess around the x-axis, and that's the analog of Rabi flopping. Okay, and it happens at a rate which is given by the Josephson coupling. So the analog of a pi pulse in NMR that turns you from down to up is you suddenly move here, you wait just the right length of time, pi h bar over ej, and you end up here, and then you suddenly move back, and you've pumped the system from here to this high energy state up here. And there's a lot of energy stored there during that, if you waited 50 picoseconds and then shut off the pulse. And you can detect which state you're in by using that energy. So this is the NEC experiment. First example of Rabi flopping in such a condensed matter system, superconductors. So here's the superconducting reservoir. Here's the little box. One detail is that this tunnel junction is actually split in two with a squid loop in the middle. So you can actually tune the strength of the Josephson coupling by frustrating it with a fraction of a flux quantum inside there. Okay, that's another knob you have. Here is some static gate that's there all the time, and then it's convenient to send the $500,000 pulse down a different wire. And how do you find out whether or not you pumped a pair into here or not? Well, remember, it's in some high energy state, and there's another electrode that's brought up with a very high impedance, much greater than H over E squared, tunnel junction here, and you make the voltage on here have the following property, that it's energetically favorable if and only if there's an extra pair here to break up one of the pairs, pay the cost, the gap delta, and have it leak out here. That's downhill in energy. And the first quasi-particle goes out in 6 nanoseconds. The second one goes out in 8 nanoseconds. And then it stops. It's uphill in energy after that. Now, so here's how you do the experiment. You set up the thing in the ground state. You pulse the gate. And then you wait and see if two electrons leak out here. Well, that's not much signal. So you do the experiment over again after it's equilibrated a few microseconds later, and you might or might not get two more electrons. And you keep doing that every microsecond or so, and you finally get a tiny current leaking out, which you can measure, which is proportional to the probability that at the end of each experiment, you left the bit up. So this is a weak, continuous measurement of the state of the system. And because this tunnel barrier is a resistance much larger than the quantum of resistance, it turns out it's a weak measurement. It's not so strong that it immediately tells you the number in there and immediately lose all information about phase and so forth. So the excited state, the ground state is n Cooper pairs in the box, when there's no gate voltage, that's the ground state, and the excited state is n plus 1 pairs. Well, that's the experiment that my colleague Rob Sholkoff is going to attempt to do with a single electron RF transistor and do a almost one-shot measurement instead of repeating the measurement millions of times and building up statistics, which is what this is an amazingly difficult experiment, and has, you can see here, the Rabi oscillations. This is the length of time that the pulse was on, and you see the pulse-induced current after doing the experiment, leaving it on this length of time and repeating millions of times and finding out on average how much current leaked out, you get these oscillations in the current. Now what we Rob Sholkoff wants to do is do the experiment once and then have something which is called an RF set. It's a very sensitive electrometer which can detect whether or not there's one or two electrons on that box. No, that's not correct. There's a back action. There's a whole theory that is beginning to be understood now about the back action of electrometers on these boxes, which guarantees that if you know how much charge is there, you've lost the phase information. And the question is, how close to this quantum limit can you come? And they have demonstrated amplifiers whose energy product, the energy sensitivity times the divided by the bandwidth is 40 H bar. So if you can get the theoretical limit is H bar. Okay, well, I've sort of run out of time, but I'll just very briefly mention what kind of dephasing and relaxation you can have in this system. This gate that's coming in from the outside can carry noise from the environment, real noise, non-equilibrium noise, or just vacuum fluctuations. And the analog of, you know, spontaneous decay of an atom by emitting photons is for this thing to fall down and launch some wave down the electromagnetic wave down this gate. And what kind of dephasing you get depends on whether you're here or here, because the gate couples to sigma z. And if you're operating here, you're already in eigenstates of sigma z, so it can't cause decays, but it can cause the levels to split and causes dephasing. So T1's large and T2 is small. If you're operating here, you're in these eigenstates of sigma x, and so the noise in this term can cause decay, okay? However, if you look at what happens to the energy splitting, it's an extremum with respect to this voltage. So if there's small noise on there, the phase doesn't get screwed up because the energy splitting is first order invariant to that. Okay, so if I have a state which is a linear combination of n and n plus 1 with some relative phase, and I don't know whether it's n or n plus 1. Yeah.
That's off the measure. Huh?
Well, so there's a basis of states, which is zero extra pairs and one extra pair. That's a basis. Yeah. But a general state is a coherent superposition of those two with some relative phase.
Sure, that's true. You said
that. And
one of the acidic part one, look at the excited state, how do you say it's something?
Oh, okay. Yeah, what I'm saying is suppose I'm operating here.
Yeah.
And I put the system either, I could put it in a coherent superposition of these two possibilities and ask about phase errors in that. And that's what this type of noise causes, because it causes the level splitting too. So if I were in a, I didn't know which I was in. I had a linear combination that was coherent. Yeah, I realized I didn't make that clear. So it's precessing at a rate given by this splitting, and that phase can get screwed up. Now, I didn't make it clear. But if I'm definitely sitting here and ask, how long does it take before the energy leaves? That's the other question you can ask. Okay. So it's kind of cute. I'll stop after this, but just for Tony's benefit. Here's the box, okay? Here's the gate. Relativity is important because there's a, you know, the speed of light is finite. And so you can model this as a transmission line with some inductance and capacitance per unit length. And the vacuum fluctuations of the system here couple into this and cause decays, just like the 2p state of hydrogen decaying. And I can define a field theta which is related to the voltage and the charge density and the current, and its Euclidean action is this, Tony recognizes. And so the boundary correlations, the correlations of this field theta, of this relativistic boson field at the boundary, determine the vacuum fluctuations seen by this guy. And you can solve from that correlation function for the spectral density of the noise and back in real time, as opposed to Euclidean time.
Wait, you told us how to make a 1 qubit out of the box, yeah. Right? How do you put several qubits?
That's a problem which I haven't talked about and hasn't been solved yet.
I mean, that's because it has very important logic things.
Yeah, right. That's there's some ideas around, but it's they haven't been tried yet, so I'm not going to talk about it. So the spectral density, the quantum noise rises linearly with frequency. There's none at negative frequencies because you can't emit vacuum fluctuation energy. You can only absorb energy into the vacuum. And basically, the bottom line is the figure of merit is the Rabi flopping rate, this splitting, times the lifetime. And that's got 1 over the fine structure constant and some dimensionless ratio of some capacitances in there. And it's big enough to be interesting, 10 to the 4th or 10 to the 6th. And you need roughly that many, if they say, if you're going to start doing quantum error correction and make the computer really work. But I think it's pretty optimistic. So there's lots of proposed pieces of hardware. I would say that the ion trap people have the best control of fidelity of operations and so forth. And maybe they can use these shuttles to move things around from memory and make the system scalable. NMR on small molecules and bulk liquids is going to be hard to scale because you just have to make bigger molecules. Cooper boxes, the 2-bit gate is a problem. There are ideas for that, but the main problem right now that we're proposing to study is the grubby stuff like 1 over F noise, because these are charged, and a few nanovolts will dephase you in a few microseconds, so that's bad. And likewise, all these other systems, there's an interesting one here, they all have some problems. So I think the attempt to study, you know, how to make these things, engineer these things to be more coherent is going to give us some interesting physics, even if we don't end up with a computer. But in the long run, you never know. Maybe you know, it's hard to say what will happen. So I'll leave it at that. Doug.
Steve, can you make your, once you make the vacuum that you were picking up the fluctuations from out of a strip line of a particular type that has a band gap, can you alter the nature of the spectrum that's causing you?
Right. So can I do cavity QED in which the cavity is not allowed, doesn't have an allowed photon mode at the relevant frequency? And the answer is yes. And that experiment actually has already been done. John Martinez, when he was a postdoc at Sauk Clay, looked at a tunneling event between two pieces of superconductor connected to strip lines. And then he put, so there's some other ground plane here, and he put a sliding short on there, okay? Cooper pair tunnels, launches an electromagnetic wave, it goes down, hits a sliding short, comes back, and either constructively or destructively interferes, and the Cooper pair says, oh, I can't be here, I didn't tunnel. And you can modulate the tunnel properties by sliding the short around, and it worked. So that's exactly how you can help isolate these modes from the, you can isolate them from the vacuum by removing vacuum modes at those frequencies. And that's what they do in cavity QED. You can make an atom not decay by having it, when it does decay, it tries to emit a photon at the wrong energy. Yes, sir?
Me?
Yes. I gave you such a hard time, you deserve a...
Well, I don't know enough about computers, but I know enough to know that once you have gates, you still have to connect gates to each other.
Yes.
So these ion trap people, how do you connect several ion traps together?
Well, you can show in principle that if you can do arbitrary one gate operations and arbitrary entanglements between, you know, the first and the seventh spin or whatever, you can just do these two-bit operations.
No, but physically, how do you...
No, you don't need to. If you have 10 ions and you're limiting...
One gate, right?
You're limiting your... No, there's 10 gate. There's 10 bits. 10 bits.
They all line up.
And then you can do I showed if you shine the laser on the first guy and entangle it with the phonons, then you use the bus to transmit the information down to the fifth guy, and you shine the laser on it and disentangle it from the phonon, you've entangled those two guys. So you can do two-bit operations on any pair of ions in the trap, 1 and 3, 2 and 7, anything you want. Yeah. And so it's
in pr- it's not the in computers, but the output of one gate has to be
no, but
gate
but
and all this stuff.
That's happening here. That's happening here. The results of entangling 1 and 5 affect what happens when you do something to 2 and 4 later, through the because you do 1 and 5, then you do 5 and 4, 4 and 3. They all get mixed up. So you can do universal computation 2 spins at a time. Just takes longer. So it has flexible wiring. You can hook up 1 and 5 together momentarily, right, with the lasers, and then you can hook up 2 and 5.
Steve, how many do you need before you publish a calculation or something?
Well, people are looking to factor 15. If they can do that, that's sort of the first milestone.
I'm sorry. That's what you mean. You need 15 of these guys?
No, you need you need, I don't know, 4 or 5 or something. But you need lots of fidelity for lots of operations to carry out the quantum Fourier transforms and things. You need like 50 or 100 consecutive operations.
And how many consecutive operations can they do?
Well, they've entangled 4 bits, which is, you know, 10 operations or something. I mean, it's early days.
So I'm getting a sense from your program here that you as a theorist are finding mechanisms that are prevent it from working.
Right, right. Right. Well, I mean, the one-liner I've been using is that the most interesting thing is the physics of why it won't work. But, you know, I think the attempt to make it work will be interesting. And actually, the language of quantum computation is a point of view about quantum mechanics. It's a way to think about quantum mechanics that's pretty interesting. And as I say, the optics people, the ion trap people, are really doing amazing things. And they've got little hollow optical fibers now that they send a laser beam, guided laser beam down, and then it lets the atoms go down and spew out the other end. So they're these hoses for atoms, and they can just spray them. And they can do almost anything they want. They're just very clever. So you never know what they'll be able to do in the end. So. Yeah.
These algorithms, I thought at the end of the day, was total import parity transformations of the wall 7 or whatever.
Right, but you can break it up into 2 at a time.
But these speedups are still maintaining.
Well, they're not as good. So you have, if you imagine I have 7 bits and I have to do a bunch of things over and over just to get one general unitary transformation of that. It takes a lot longer. I don't actually know. I think you still preserve at least some speed up, but I don't know enough about the quantum information side of it to actually answer that.
That's almost back to Tony's question, because
yeah.
Tony wanted you to parallel with all the data. You only work from 2 at a time.
Right, right. Well, you know, that's because they're just working with one laser.
Oh, I see.
You know, you could have lasers on each guy, and but it's harder. Everything's possible in principle.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thanks. Thanks.